Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the President's blueprint for cutting greenhouse gas emissions by nearly a third over the next decade and speak with Janet Redman, the Director of the Climate Policy Program at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. She joins us to discuss Obama's proposals that will be on the table at the UN climate negotiations in Paris in December for U.S. action on climate change, which many environmentalists already consider inadequate and which Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell considers unattainable and illegal. And then we'll look into the historic elections in Nigeria that the opposition won convincingly and speak with a former election observer in Nigeria, Dr. Robert Lloyd, a professor of international relations and the head of Pepperdine University's International Studies program. We'll discuss the resounding victory by a former military dictator, Muhammadu Buhari, over the incumbent Goodluck Jonathan, and how much this might impact the war against Boko Haram and what can be done to turn around Nigeria's oil-dependent economy at a time of falling oil prices. Then finally, we will speak with a Nigerian priest and human rights activist, Enidi Okure, the executive director of the Africa Faith and Justice Network, about whether the broom that was Buhari's election symbol will be used to sweep away Nigeria's endemic corruption so that oil revenues will reach the people of a country with a fast-growing population that is expected to reach 210 million by 2020. And joining us now is Janet Redman, the director of the Climate Policy Program at the Institute for Policy Studies. Welcome to Background Briefing, Janet Redman.
Thank you so much for having me on.
And the president announced, or the White House announced today, the president's climate change proposals, which is an agreement which the U.S. will bring to the table at the UN climate negotiations for a global agreement this December in Paris, so-called the intended nationally determined contribution. And it says that the U.S. is going to cut its emissions by 26 to 28% below 2005 levels by 2025. But I take it, what's the world going to look like in 2025 at the current rate, do you think?
I think this is exactly the problem. We're joining many other organizations and people in civil society to welcome the fact that the U.S. is making any concrete target cuts for greenhouse gas emissions. We feel like with this level of ambition, this low level of ambition, we're very concerned that 2025 will look like a scary world, but more concerningly, 2050, 2075, 2100 will look like a completely different world. Basically, the climate scientists have told us that we need to keep global warming below 2 degrees Celsius increase, so a rise of less than 2 degrees from when we started industrializing here in the global north. We have to keep temperatures below that level if we want to avoid catastrophic climate change. And they've told us that that means that developed countries will have to cut their climate pollution by at least 25 to 55% below 1990 levels by 2025. So, if your listeners remember, you had used the base year of 2005. So what the U.S. has done is kind of fudged the math a little bit by actually using a baseline that's 15 years later than the rest of the world is using. So it's kind of like the U.S. has said, we're going to decide to go on a diet on Thanksgiving, and we'll only eat half as many pies than we ate on Thanksgiving. Well, it's really different if you start your baseline at basically a glut. So, unfortunately, what the White House's announcement transfers to is an emissions cut of only 14 to 16% by 2025. So that's 2 to 3 times less than what we actually need to see the U.S. doing in order to pay our fair share into those contributions of action to avoid climate catastrophe.
But the Clean Power Plan, which is a big part of it, of course, has already got Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell up in arms. He's basically saying it's illegal. He, of course, believes that President Obama is waging this so-called war on coal. We have, as the chairman of the Senate Energy and Environment and Science Committee, we have a global warming denier who brings snowballs into the Senate to make his case. I mean, obviously, he's not aware, for example, that just this Tuesday in Antarctica, they read a temperature of 63 degrees, which is the highest temperature ever recorded in Antarctica. So, you know, my sense is that, you know, there's a tremendous battle going on here to get anything done. So what's wrong with getting something done when you have such obdurate and ignorant opposition to the reality of climate change.
No, I think that's a good point. I mean, President Obama certainly has circumstances within which he's working that are probably unparalleled in other parts of the developed world. You know, certainly folks in Europe are not having a conversation about whether climate change exists. They're talking about what to do about it. And I think, you know, my experience is that the same thing is true even in global South countries who want to continue burning fossil fuels to fuel economic growth. They're not denying that climate change is real. They're just saying it's actually the responsibility of those who caused it in the global north to take action first and most aggressively. I mean, I think it's important for us to remember that, you know, because the EPA found that regulating greenhouse gas emissions is part of its mandate under the Clean Air Act, Congress can hem and haw about the Clean Power Plan being illegal all at once, but that's already been established that the EPA actually does have responsibility for making sure that emissions from power plants and other sources is not harming the human community, is not, and it's found that climate change impacts do harm people. And so, in fact, it's absolutely legal that they are talking about the Clean Power Plan. And in fact, we'd like to see the Clean Power Plan be a lot stronger. So I think there are ways, certainly there will be an attack from the right. I expect that we will see any regulation tied up in legal battles. But that's not a good enough reason for us not to be trying to do more at the EPA. And as the EPA moves forward this year in the next 6 months, it's writing its guidelines for this Clean Power Plan that it will hand over to states so that states can start doing their own state-by-state plans, which is how this regulation will work. I don't think that should discourage us from fighting, from calling for the strongest emission cuts we can get. And it's not just because of climate change and what the planet will look like in a generation or two, which is certainly upsetting enough. But it's also because those sources of greenhouse gas pollution are also sources of the toxic pollution that impacts families who live next to them every single day. So what functionally the Republicans are calling for is a sacrifice of low-income communities and communities of color who reap the asthma, the toxic emissions, the polluted water that accompanies the continuation of burning of fossil fuels, whether it's coal, oil, or gas. All of these are fuels that create a toxic byproduct. It's not just greenhouse gas emissions. So I think there's a piece that we need to pick up as responsible citizens, even if we're not living in those communities that are directly impacted, to say, yes, we need to make sure that climate change is stopped, is halted, is slowed down, but also we have a responsibility to say we don't want our energy, our electricity, our power to come from sources that are polluting our neighbors and our fellow country people. So I think maybe part of our strategy around climate deniers is to look at the public health angle and talk about that more clearly. But I don't think just because they're deniers, and they're a small group, unfortunately they hold a lot of seats in Congress right now and some important seats, it's a small number of people who actually are still denying that climate change is real. And it's important that we expose their interest in keeping us in the dark around climate change and stopping us from regulating greenhouse gas emissions.
And again, I'm speaking with Janet Redmond, the director of the Climate Policy Program at the Institute for Policy Studies. We're talking about the president's plan released today that will be tabled at the UN Climate Negotiations for a Global Agreement this December in Paris. It's called the Intended Nationally Determined Contributions, where the U.S. proposes to cut emissions by 26 to 28% below 2005 levels by 2025. And when people like Mitch McConnell talk about President Obama's so-called war on coal, my sense is that I wish there really was a war on coal, because we know that these stationary sources that burn coal are the biggest contributors of CO2 emissions. They're extremely identifiable, and they are, in fact, the problem. And I don't know that, you know, you can pussyfoot around this issue when you've got...
I think that's right.
Don't you think that maybe we need an educator-in-chief, a teacher-in-chief here to take these people on, as opposed to continually being, you know, insulted by them when they, you know, put forth absolute nonsense?
I think part of it is, yeah, I think there are a couple of things going on. I think the right is, it's not just waging a war against climate change and people who care about whether the planet, you know, is habitable for human beings in 50 or 75 years. It's, you know, it's been waging a war against science and looking at reason and looking at scientific data instead of using cute stories about, look, there's snow in winter, so climate change isn't real. It's, they're not being serious about the science. And I think what we need to look most concretely at is, it's not that their kids aren't going to also live in a world that's horribly disrupted when climate change comes to roost, and it's already happening now. I think that there are folks whose financial interests who are worried about making sure that we maintain a economic structure where corporations continue to benefit, where corporate and private sector power is unchecked. Part of the way that our energy system works, a centralized fossil-fueled energy system that benefits immensely from public tax dollars, that makes it some of the most profitable industry in the world, there are lots of interests that don't want that change, and those are powerful interests. And so I think what the right has done well is to simplify arguments to make it feel unbelievable that climate change is happening, that we could possibly be responsible for helping change it. And so I think what people who are clear about climate science need to do is start being much more clear in how they communicate about it. So the kinds of disasters we're seeing today, whether it be wildfires or floods or droughts or increased intensity of tropical storms, increased coastal flooding because of sea level rise, there are lots of scientists who say you can't point to any one of these disasters and say it's climate change. But scientists have been telling us for 20 years and more now that these are the kinds of things we will see happen when climate change occurs. I think part of what's tough is we're trying to be, unlike climate deniers, we're trying to be so accurate that we make it more complicated than it really is for people to understand. The reality is we have made the climate warmer, and that means that the way we understand climate is changing. The society we've built for a certain kind of world no longer fits that world because we've been changing that climate enough that it's a mismatch. And so there's an emergency. We need to take action quickly. And I think, unfortunately, what will end up motivating people is when disaster strikes them at home. I think that happened with Hurricane Sandy. I think that's happened with wildfires in California, with droughts in California. I believe that we're smarter than that. I believe that there are many people that can see the benefit of preventing climate disaster. I think, unfortunately, we haven't translated that into political pressure in the centers of power, in particular, particularly here in Washington, D.C. So, you know, this might be a time to call for continuing pressure at the White House, but continuing pressure in Congress, but actually moving to the local level where we can be more active in our local governance, and we can change energy, climate, water, land use at the local level and start making a difference there now.
So given that the president has signed onto the UN accords, which were signed in Lima, and this agreement will be forged in Paris in December, and as of now, only the European Union, Mexico, Norway, and Switzerland have previously joined onto the regime. China, India, Brazil, and Russia haven't, but they are expected to submit plans at least by June, although some may be delayed until October. I'm just curious to know why the other piece of evidence that could be used to just to get this debate out of this sort of cul-de-sac of denial into onto the fast track of reality, because we're running out of time, is, for example, the example of Germany. I mean, here's a country that gets this appalling weather, but yet gets most of its energy now from the wind and the sun, and got rid of nuclear, which everybody, or at least a lot of people, think is an alternative to a viable alternative to getting rid of coal and other polluting sources. Obviously, the Germans don't think that way, and most scientists also think that nuclear is not an option. Of course, everybody's touting a natural gas and the natural gas boon from fracking here in the United States, but nobody's done an inventory on how much leakage of methane there is, and a leakage of methane would offset any gains that you would have for burning natural gas, which is, I think, 50% less damaging than coal, but still damaging. So it feels like we have an example of a country that's already done what we're still debating we should or should not do. Do you think that, you know, that we need to sort of publicize that more, perhaps, or at least?
Absolutely. I mean, what's actually most exciting, I think, about what's happening in Germany is that 60% of the energy is made by people in their own homes. 60% of people are producing solar electricity and actually selling it back into the national grid and making money at the household level while producing clean energy for the country. So that's remarkable. And that happened because Germany decided they were going to have a simple policy called a feed-in tariff that would guarantee prices for renewable energy. It made it affordable. It meant that in the long term, people could pay off the cost of their solar panels while producing clean energy and getting themselves off of fossil fuels. So, you know, part of it's stretching our imagination, and part of it's just making some sound public policy. You know, and if you remember, the ban on nuclear happened after Fukushima. So partly people in Germany are learning the lessons of what's happening around them in the global landscape. So I think the United States has to take advantage of the possibilities that are around it right now. This is not rocket science. This is stuff that other countries are doing. It's stuff that we have in certain states. For example, we have feed-in tariffs in certain states, municipalities, but we don't have it at a national level. Those are the kinds of policies we could do right now that would actually change the energy economy, that would change the system of how we make electricity, not just moving from coal to natural gas and natural gas as a bridge fuel, but actually saying, no, we're gonna shift the way we do energy production overall, and we're gonna make it affordable for families to put solar panels on their own rooftop. We're gonna make people responsible for their own energy production as well as consumption, and change the way we think about power, change the way we think about electricity and that kind of power, but change the way we think about citizen power and our role in deciding where we get our energy, where we get our electricity, and what's viable.
Well, we have here in Los Angeles the Department of Water and Power, which is sort of, the public owns it, but it's such a sclerotic bureaucracy that they really aren't getting behind a program. I know the mayor is trying to get of Los Angeles is trying to make this a sustainable and renewable city. And it makes no sense, of course. You've got endless sun here in California, which they don't have in Germany. But I guess the lesson of Germany, though, is that it absolutely proves that rather than destroy the economy, which the Mitch McConnells of the world are arguing that if you get rid of these polluting coal plants, suddenly, you know, you're living in the dark in a cave, the opposite is true, that you can actually have a sustainable and even profitable and more profitable economy from the innovations of citizen-controlled energy.
That's right. I mean, and there's an important statistic that Mitch McConnell should be shown, I think, over and over again. For every dollar you spend in fossil fuels, you create one job. But for that same dollar, you create three jobs in the renewable energy sector. So shifting to renewable energy is a jobs creation program. I think it's interesting that you raise this idea of the fact that people do control water and electricity, although it's not run that way. The same experience has been happening in rural electricity co-ops. And so those are the co-ops that were produced, you know, mainly actually to support farmers and their needs. And they're cooperative. They're actually owned by the people who use that electricity. But unfortunately, many of the boards of those co-ops are more run like a corporation, like a cooperative. So there are some structures like that we could actually take back. And there are many people now working at the local level and the regional level to say, wait a second, this co-op is our co-op. This is our cooperative. We could make changes in the way we decide electricity is produced and purchased through this rural electricity cooperative. And I think there are municipal utilities that are also shifting to renewable energy. There are lots of structures that we can see in our local arena that we can organize with our neighbors, with people in our towns and our regions to say, wait a minute, maybe we can use these structures to actually change the energy economy locally. So we don't have to wait for leadership from the federal level. We can actually start making the difference here. And then eventually, once those models become commonplace and known, I think we help to debunk the idea that shifting to a clean energy economy actually, you know, loses jobs, and in fact shows that it's better for our pocketbooks, it's better for our wallets, it's better for job creation, as well as better for our health and our planet.
Well, let's hope that the citizens of Los Angeles storm the Department of Water and Power and point out to them that they own the DWP, and it's time for the DWP to plug in solar, make these incentives, allow people to generate their own electricity and get compensated for it, as they do in Germany, because it's such a logical way to go. And as I say, I can only hope that these lessons somehow reach us. And I thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
And again, I've been speaking with Janet Redmond, who's the director of the Climate Policy Program at the Institute for Policy Studies. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back looking to the historic elections in Nigeria. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Robert Lloyd, who's a professor of international relations and head of Pepperdine University's International Studies Program. He is also a Fulbright Scholar to India and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council in Washington, D.C. Dr. Lloyd has been an election observer, observing presidential elections in Nigeria and Liberia, and was an election observer for the United States Department of State and the United Nations during Mozambique's first multi-party elections following its civil war. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Robert Lloyd.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
And many people are talking about the elections that just took place in Nigeria over the weekends as being historic, in as much as with the concessionary phone call from Goodluck Jonathan to Muhammadu Buhari, it would seem that the possibility of post-election violence has diminished considerably.
Yes, I think that's true. There was concerns about post-election violence, which has been, I hate to say, somewhat traditional after each presidential election cycle. And the election observers who have been there, both domestic and international, have generally pronounced themselves fairly happy with the process of the polling. The opposition did appear to win, by all accounts, and the president has conceded. So the process and the transition at this point look quite positive.
And he's won convincingly, hasn't he, Buhari?
Yes, he did. It was one of those, running up to it, there were some polls that had come out from Afrobarometer, which showed it would be a close race even from December 2014 moving forward. Towards the end, there was a slight break towards the opposition party. And so apparently that momentum continued and they won the election.
Well, the government did intervene, at least the top security people did intervene and delayed the elections by an extra 6 weeks, which gave the incumbent, Goodluck Jonathan, an extra 6 weeks of campaigning. And since he has considerably more financial resources, that was an advantage. And, of course, it gave the incumbent, Goodluck Jonathan, an opportunity to go on the military offensive against Boko Haram. But that appears to have backfired because the average Nigerian is basically saying, well, how come you haven't been able to defeat these insurgents for years? And now in the last 6 weeks, thanks to, I believe, South African mercenaries, you've gone on the offensive. So why did it take you so long? Do you think that message resonated throughout the country?
I think it was very clear when I was there a few weeks ago and talking with Nigerians and talking to officials that there were serious questions as to why in the past 6 years the government has not been able to respond effectively to Boko Haram, which has been located primarily in three states in the Northeast and has created a lot of mayhem and damage in those areas. The government, the security forces in the government said that they needed to delay the elections in order to address the issue of Boko Haram and insecurity in those three states. The response of the government security forces has been much more effective this time than in the past, which has raised the questions. But one factor that's also different is that Boko Haram started attacking neighboring countries as well, and those countries joined in the battle. And so Boko Haram was now facing more of a united front in places like Cameroon, Niger, and Chad. So that was one difference from before, which was definitely a factor.
But there is a number of reports that indicate that the real sort of tip of the spear in driving Boko Haram out of much of the north has been South African mercenaries.
Okay.
Is that your understanding?
I would say my understanding is more effective military operations, and there's been much more African Union and regional cooperation than before.
Uh-huh.
So Boko Haram had been attacking neighboring countries, and the neighboring countries had been very effective in countering these attacks. So I would say there's a number of factors. I couldn't speculate on that particular South African mercenary connection. I just don't have enough information
sure.
to determine what role, if any, was played.
But certainly it's a bit puzzling, isn't it, Dr. Robert Lloyd, that a country that's been run by military governments for a long time appeared to be so feckless militarily against an insurgency and took them so long. And while I was covering it over the last few years, there have been reports that the soldiers don't have, maybe they have 30 bullets in a magazine and that's it. So there have been reports that Goodluck Jonathan sort of starved the military because there's been a tradition of military coups. So what would your explanation be for why the Nigerian military have been unable to combat Boko Haram until very recently?
Yes, I've heard that explanation. I've also heard explanations that Boko Haram had infiltrated the government and so had information on attacks. I mean, there's been a lot of explanations. I'm not in a position to really determine the ins and outs of the security situation. What I can say is that one can argue that either the Nigerian military was unable or it was unwilling to take the fight to Boko Haram. And it seemed in the past few years that they didn't show much ability to take the fight to Boko Haram, and they were always on the defensive and withdrawing. And in the conflicts, Boko Haram seemed to always have the advantage. And so that shows an unwillingness to and an inability to fight. This was the shocker, because this is the same country that is the leading military power in the economic community of West African states, which has a military wing, the economic which has been effective in addressing insecurity in places like Liberia and Sierra Leone. So this is why it was a big shock in Nigeria, given how their success has been in other insurgencies, if you will, in other countries in West Africa, not to be able to do it in their own country. The good news is there does seem to be progress now. And it could be that Boko Haram overplayed its hand as well by attacking neighboring countries.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Robert Lloyd, who's a professor of international relations and the head of Pepperdine University's International Studies Program. He's also a Fulbright Scholar to India and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council in Washington, D.C. And Dr. Lloyd has been an election observer, observing presidential elections in Nigeria and Liberia, and was also an election observer for the U.S. Department of State and the United Nations during Mozambique's first multi-party elections following its civil war. Well, either way, it would seem, Dr. Lloyd, that what's been happening with Boko Haram has played right into Muhammadu Buhari's hands. Being a former general, my understanding is that a part of the reasons for his election sweep, and part of it, of course, is that his symbol was a broom, which he carried around with him to sweep clean the corruption that's endemic in the country. But the other factor I understand from polls and reporting in Nigeria has been that the Nigerian people expect this former general, who lives modestly and apparently is fairly incorruptible, that he's going to be more militarily effective against Boko Haram.
Yes, I think that's the expectation. When I was there a few weeks ago, I had the opportunity to interview him and talk to him, and he expressed, frustration about Boko Haram and the government's response to it, which isn't any different from what he said publicly. He has a military background. He's Muslim, and Goodluck Jonathan is a Christian. So in the divide that you see within Nigeria, he had, Buhari has credibility in the sense that he's frustrated about the impact that Boko Haram has. And interestingly, he also carried Christians in the southwest portion of the country who sort of crossed religious lines to vote for him and support him. And so that was an interesting development to overcome that I think speaks well for Nigeria and Nigerians and that voting across sort of religious divides. And that should be brought out as well, that he enjoyed a fairly broad backing in society.
And did you find him? Well, tell me, how did you find him? Because the former U.S. Ambassador John Campbell was telling me the other day that he lives very modestly. When you go to his home, he opens the door, and even when he was in power, he was fairly strict, from what I understand, and he was, a military dictator. But on the other hand, apparently he seems, at least in a country where corruption is endemic, he doesn't seem to have fallen prey to it.
Well, he struck me as a very serious man. He was concerned about Nigeria. The energy level, I don't know, he's a little bit older man than he was, in the days when he was head of state, when he was general.
He's 72, right?
Yes. But he was quiet. He listened on the questions. He paid attention to us. I thought this was a man who listened. He was willing to interact.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that spoke well for him.
And do you think his campaign, using the broom as a symbol to sweep out corruption, I mean, that appears to have been effective, right?
Well, he is known for his anti-corruption drives. There's no doubt about it. And there's no doubt about it that Nigerians are concerned about corruption. Just the elections, if you take a look at the elections and the election commission, all the steps that the government took, the election commission took, to address the issues of try to have a clean election. I think that also speaks well for the Nigerians, and in the sense that at each step of the way, they really tried to have a whole series, in terms of the identity cards, the system set up, keeping track of the ballots, keeping track of the votes as they got collated and then sent up to the federal level. At each step, there was concerns about corruption and concerns about undermining the election in that way. So I think yes, there are issues of corruption, but you also see Nigerians frustrated with it. And I think part of the vote was, for Buhari, was related to that.
Well, I remember covering, I guess it was 6 months ago or so, the case of the head of the central bank who was fired because he exposed some $30 billion that were missing from oil revenues. I mean, that was pretty extraordinary. And from what I remember, nothing was ever resolved. I mean, it sounds like there's not a lot of transparency in what happens to the oil revenues, which, of course, this is an oil-dependent country. And, the price of oil is dropping, so it's a...
Yes. Yes, that was a shocker. And there's no doubt that the memory of that has not disappeared in Nigeria, where essentially you had an individual who's questioning the use of the location or whereabouts of phenomenal amounts of money. And Nigeria is a fairly poor country, so this is a lot of money anyway, and it's a lot of money in a relatively poor country. And the response is he's sacked, and there's no formal investigation into whether or not this is an accurate charge or not. To the best of my knowledge, there was no follow-up to determine whether or not this was a correct statement or not.
Well, that's what certainly it's puzzled me. But what do you think can be done? What can Buhari's administration do to turn things around, given that this is a sort of, oil-dependent country and an oil-dependent economy? Its population is expected to grow to 210 million by 2020, and terrible distribution of wealth. I guess the one point you made earlier, that this is a Muslim leader in a country that's divided 50-50 between Christians in the south and Muslims in the north, and a lot of Christians voted for him. So it sounds like he has something of a mandate. But do you think he can find out what happened to all that missing money?
Well, I think he has the opportunity. Certainly he has the opportunity. Nigeria faces two major issues right now. And the first one is insecurity in the northeast with Boko Haram, which has really sapped the self-confidence. It's killed people. It's damaged property. It's undermined people's livelihoods and lives in the northeastern part of the country. That's a serious concern, which has spread out to the, and that's an issue that has to be addressed, so that people can go about their lives, free from the worry of being attacked or killed or their property damaged. The second is the price of oil has dropped. And as you said, it's an oil-dependent economy. Nigeria has got to diversify its economy, and it's taking steps on that. But in the short term, the Naira, which is the Nigerian currency, has been dropping substantially, which makes the cost of imports go up quite a bit, which can also tie in with inflation. Thus far, inflation rate's been modestly increasing, but as prices begin to circulate, you can expect an increase in the inflation rate, as well as decreased money in the government because there's lower oil revenue, which can be a very difficult situation for a new leader coming in with high expectations, coming in at a time when the economy is in very serious concern.
So do you think, though, that in terms of this pretty surprising turnaround where this former military dictator who sort of renounced, you know, any kind of dictatorial past and says he's a believer in democracy, and he's 72 years old, he gets elected in what looks like a pretty decent sort of landslide, and the incumbent who didn't prosecute a war until recently against Boko Haram and seemed unbelievably lackadaisical about the kidnapping of almost 300 schoolgirls, which got international attention. And when the parents of the schoolgirls that were missing demonstrated in front of Goodluck Jonathan's palace, his wife, you know, accused them of being traitors and undermining the good name of the country. I was always surprised at how seemingly indifferent he was to the plight of those girls, whose fate still is unknown.
Mm-hmm.
What was your sense of it? Can you explain?
Well, it was interesting when we were talking to Buhari and interviewing about the election. I was part of a joint International Republican Institute, National Democratic Institute delegation for the pre-assessment of the election. Basically, we interviewed people, we took a look at the situation, we came up with a list of recommendations and evaluations. So as part of that, we interviewed him. And while we were there, one of the leaders of the Bring Back Our Girls movement, a Nigerian woman, she came in and we talked to her, and she gave us some background and what they were doing. I thought it was interesting that she was allied with Buhari. You know, it was clearly they were connected, and this was a concern for her and a concern for him. So there, you know, there was a very strong link right there and support for doing what you can. And I think, you know, Buhari was saying, look, there's insecurity. We need to do something about this. But it just wasn't the girls who were kidnapped. You know, there had been other kidnappings, and there also had been killings of children, boys in the area. So it's a much broader picture. And there was frustration, clear frustration in Nigerian society about the government's inability to end the Boko Haram insurgency and the fact that Boko Haram was now controlling territory in Nigeria. And so clearly with Goodluck Jonathan, that undermined public support for him. And really in an extraordinary way, if you think about Nigeria today, Nigeria became democratic on its most recent swing into democracy from military rule in 1999. The party that has continued to win has been the PDP, People's Democratic Party, the ruling party. And here you have it, and there's been the traditional shift in Nigeria between sort of a northern president, Muslim president, and southern Christian president. And so that's functioned. And all of a sudden you have a situation where the party changes to a different party. And that's really extraordinary in a country like Nigeria. I mean, in many ways, it bodes well because it's fine and dandy to say we support democracy and democratization if you're the party that keeps winning. So then democracy becomes instrumental. We'd like it because we get power. But then all of a sudden to say we support this and you lose power and you willingly step down, that speaks volumes. And Nigeria is a leader in Africa. People look at Nigeria very closely because what happens in Nigeria doesn't stay in Nigeria. Other African countries look at it. When Nigeria goes to African forums and say, look, you know, this is what we need to do. We need to support democratization. We need to, you know, we need to do these things. Other countries pay attention because this is what happened in Nigeria. So it's really it's an extraordinary development in Nigeria and has important ramifications in Africa as well.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Robert Lloyd, I mean, at this point, there are indications that things have calmed down and that the concession really did dampen down passions from those that feel either that they lost or the election was stolen. And that cycle perhaps has been broken. Given the economic prognosis, do you think that that we could be having this conversation in a few years' time and things could be on the mend in Nigeria?
Well, yes. I guess I've always been fairly optimistic about Nigeria in the sense that Nigeria has had these bouts of authoritarian military dictatorships under Sani Abacha, for instance, really bad military rule. And each time, Nigeria has pushed back towards an inclusive, more democratic society. Now, it's not been perfect. They would be the first to admit that. But there's that underlying push. And if you take a look at this, this most recent phase has been longer than before, and it has deepened and broadened, and you actually now have successive administrations in the same party, and now you're moving towards an administration from a rival party. And all of that, all of it is really quite new for Nigeria. And again, Nigeria is, people pay attention to Nigeria in Africa and elsewhere. So I think, let's take a look at it this way. Say in 4 years' time, Buhari decides to run again, just for the sake of argument. And he runs up against a re-energized PDP, which is now the opposition party. And he loses. His party loses. He played by a game, and he would understand that the rules were he came in power because the PDP, the ruling party, now steps down. It makes it very hard for him to now argue the opposite. So it institutionalizes some of the processes and some of the expectations within Nigeria, which I think is really important.
Well, Dr. Robert Lloyd,
So I'm very optimistic in that sense.
Well, Dr. Robert Lloyd, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for this opportunity to speak with you.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Robert Lloyd, who's a professor of international relations and head of Pepperdine University's International Studies Program. He's also a Fulbright Scholar to India and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council in Washington, D.C. Dr. Lloyd has been an election observer observing presidential elections in Nigeria and Liberia and was an election observer for the United States Department of State and the United Nations during Mozambique's first multi-party elections following its civil war. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into whether the winner of the Nigerian election will be able to sweep away Nigeria's endemic corruption.
Some bread, hey-ya. Someone nearly died, hey-ya. Someone just died, hey-ya. Police they come, army they come, hey-ya. Confusion everywhere, seven minutes later, all don't cool down, brother, police don't go away, army don't disappear, them leave sorrow, tears and blood.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Anidi Okure, who is Executive Director of Africa Faith and Justice Network, a community of advocates for responsible U.S. relations with Africa. He is a member of the Order of the Preachers of the Dominican Province of St. Joseph, the Worker, in Nigeria, and has served in various pastoral capacities in Nigeria, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and the United States. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anidi Okure.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
And I take it you're a happy man, Anidi, with the results of the elections in Nigeria.
I am very, very happy. In fact, I'm really feeling elated for several reasons. One, that the election is over. And two, that it went peacefully. And three, that the incumbent president found it in his heart to call the elected candidate immediately to congratulate him. That's something Nigerians should be proud of. I think they have set an example in many ways, and especially given that it is the first time, at least in Nigeria's electoral history, that an incumbent candidate lost election. So history is being made today in Nigeria.
And do you think that the campaign that Muhammadu Buhari ran, where he used the broom as a symbol of sweeping out corruption, that clearly resonated with the people? They're tired of corruption, aren't they?
That resonated with a lot of people. You know, it's very unfortunate what's happening with our lawmakers. You know, there is real, it's not just corruption, it's acute corruption. It's really serious. And on top of that is the lack of the rule of law. You know, there are many instances where an official is caught red-handed, literally, with massive corruption. He's tried, he or she is tried, and then the next thing, the person is walking around the streets. You know, nobody is brought to justice. You know, there's a case in point where somebody embezzled about 2 billion naira of teachers' pension fund. And he got a slap on the wrist and is walking around. So people see this over and over and they are tired. They really wanted a change, even if it comes from a former military ruler. They were eager for a change. And the reason that the people resonate with this particular candidate, Muhammadu Buhari, is that during his time as a military ruler, he was noted for two things. One, he really wanted to put the rule of law in place. He wanted to bring order to the society. And secondly, people see him as, if you want to open the Hall of Fame of corruption, you wouldn't be able to put him there, you know. So given all of that, people see him as an alternative candidate, and in fact, a credible candidate this time around. More so that there was also serious internal disgruntlement within the party itself, I mean within PDP. So the crumbling party in itself, shown by defections, even among high-ranking members. Key party members defected. Even former President Olusegun Obasanjo, who is the godfather of the current president, came out openly criticizing Jonathan. And the former vice president decamped from PDP to join APC. So there are a number of factors that made many Nigerians, even when they don't particularly agree with what Buhari did as a military leader, they see him as somebody who will be able to bring about some changes. Now, I want to say that he's not going to have an easy time. Namely, you know, the president, the incoming president, is not going to have an easy time because the economy, as we know it, is taking a nosedive in many ways, but we hope that he can stop it from going that way. However, if the oil prices, as we know it, continue to go down, then that is going to adversely affect the economy and therefore his ability to do certain things he thinks he can do. On the other hand, many people also saw him or see him as one who will be able to deal expeditiously with the security issue. You know, since the last 6 years, Boko Haram has killed about 13,000 people, has displaced about 2 million people. The economy of the Northeast has collapsed. People from the South, who were mostly merchants and keeping the economy going, have fled. And people started suspecting, how come that a country with Africa's largest army, who is noted for peacekeeping, not just in West Africa, but throughout the continent, is not capable to contain a ragtag sectarian group that turned deadly. So most Nigerians concluded that it was not so much a lack of ability, it was rather a lack of will from Abuja that enabled Boko Haram to cause such disruption to the lives of people.
So let me remind the audience again that I'm speaking with Anidi Okoro. He's the Executive Director of Africa Faith and Justice Network, a community of advocates for responsible U.S. relations with Africa. He is a member of the Order of Preachers of in the Dominican province of St. Joseph the Worker in Nigeria and served in various pastoral capacities in Nigeria, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and the United States. And since you are a Christian, obviously you're a preacher.
Yes, I am.
So the idea that you support a Muslim, that, you know, in these very sectarian times with all of this, you know, Islamic State stuff going on in the Middle East and the Boko Haram in Nigeria, the way that the press covers these things would give one the impression that the world is becoming incredibly sectarian and Christians and Muslims will never reconcile. And it's clearly not the case in Nigeria.
It's not the case, you know, because Nigerians recognize Boko Haram for what Boko Haram is. In the southwest of Nigeria, you have Muslims and Christians living side by side for years, and they continue to do so. Nigerians recognize that, yes, there are some fanatics in given religion, even Christian fanatics as well. But then Nigerians also recognize that the issues that affect the country is larger than religion or ethnicity. And so they are willing to rise above that to look at who can best serve Nigeria at this time. And so given that, they said, okay, let's put religion aside, let's put ethnicity aside, let's look at the candidate for what they can offer. And that's what happened here. And actually, I am so proud, not just that he got elected, but I'm so proud of the electorate, because the way they engage the issues, especially in the last 6 weeks since it was postponed from February 14th, they engage the issues, and I see a true democratic process emerging. Now, if we recall that in 2011, the voting for the presidency was split Nigeria in half. The North overwhelmingly voted for Buhari, who was running at the time. The South all unanimously voted for President Goodluck Jonathan. That is not the case today. You know, what has happened today is that both candidates won both in the North and in the South, with pockets of places that people didn't think APC would win. So it's really reflecting a maturity of the democratic process coming out of that country. And I hope that the neighboring countries and places like the Democratic Republic of Congo, Uganda, Rwanda, Burundi, Uncle Mugabe and co. will see what is happening in Nigeria and borrow a leaf from it.
So what kind of rule do you expect from Buhari? Because a lot of the critics in Nigeria say that he wants to introduce Sharia law, for example.
You know, I've heard that too, but I think those who are saying that are not cognizant of the fact that we are not in a military regime. We have a democratically elected Congress that deliberates on issues, that votes on issues, that pass law, that enacts law, that also supposedly uphold the rule of law, which hasn't been very good, but nonetheless, that body is there. So to think that one person will wake up one morning and said, oh, we want to Islamize the country, I think it's a dream that passes utopia. And secondly, he's the vice president-elect, not only is a Christian, has been a pastor himself. So I don't know, are people thinking that somebody with that kind of background will just sit and wait and the president will unilaterally declare Nigeria an Islamic state? No. Whatever happens, in fact, whether it's a president who is a Christian or a Muslim, whatever happens in the religious era, in the religious arena, is something that is independent of the presidency. And mind you, when Buhari was president, he was one of those who was quick to crush Islamic insurgency, you know. So if he really wanted to Islamize the country at the time when he was military ruler and his deputy was also a Muslim, two of them, they were both Muslims, we didn't see that. So I don't know how people just concoct stuff without looking at the current situation or even look at the history of this particular candidate when he was head of state.
Well,
so
just
that is totally unfounded.
Well, just in closing, Anidi, it would seem that the people in Nigeria voted for Buhari because he's a former general and he's promised to crush Boko Haram.
Yes, and I think he will. He has said that the group is an evil group, so there should not even be a negotiation with them. They said if he's elected, he's not going to negotiate, he's going to mobilize the military. This is a war situation and you fight war and win. So I think he's going to do just that. And I think also he's going to boost the morale of the military who have felt so demoralized with what is happening.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Anidi Okorie.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Anidi Okorie, who's the Executive Director of the Africa Faith and Justice Network, a community of advocates for responsible U.S. relations with Africa. He is a member of the Order of Preachers of the Dominican Province of St. Joseph the Worker in Nigeria and served in various pastoral capacities in Nigeria, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and the United States. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Molly Lewis. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.